Hey there, I'm Steve Lehman, and this is the debut episode of the In Layman's Terms podcast. Some of you may know I'm the sports anchor at News Channel 5 in Nashville, also the play-by-play voice of Belmont Bruins basketball, ready for a second season of college basketball behind the mic. And as we begin this podcast, I want to give you a little thoughts of what it's going to be. It's going to be things that I'm interested in, particularly involving college basketball and, of course, the school I love in Belmont and all the things that have to do with the program, the school, in particularly college basketball. And who better to visit with to start this podcast than the architect of Belmont basketball, one of the great basketball programs over the last quarter century, and that would be Hall of Fame coach Rick Byrd, 805 game winner, a Hall of Famer on multiple levels, and of course took Belmont to several NCAA tournaments. During our chat, we'll discuss his time at Belmont, all 33 years, his thoughts on the Bruins' transition into the Missouri Valley Conference, reflections on his career and potential coaching opportunities, and why he stayed at Belmont for all of those years. We'll also get into the current state of college athletics and college basketball in general to get his thoughts and feelings on the direction of the sport today. Make sure to like and subscribe this podcast for future notifications, because we've got an exciting list of guests lined up over the course of this winter. We hope you'll enjoy them. So sit back and relax as we get to our very first episode of In Layman's Terms with our first guest, the legendary Rick Byrd. Well, I can't think of anyone more fitting to start off as our first guest on this podcast than the one and only Rick Byrd. Coach, how are you doing this morning?
I'm great. Thanks, Steve.
Well, it's great to talk to you, as always, for sure. And it's that time of year. We're getting right to the start of the college basketball season. You've been out of it for a couple of years in terms of the coaching part. But when we get to this time of year, do you get that itch still that you feel like you should be on the bench?
Oh, gosh. You know, not really. I think I was ready in terms of the coaching part of it. I certainly miss being around the kids that I got to coach and the staffs that I had and the people I worked with on a daily basis. But, you know, it was 33 years at Belmont, but it was 40 plus overall. And so watching my little granddaughter is a little more fun right now than coaching basketball.
Yeah, you've got grandpa duty, which is a lot of fun, I'm sure. And you always talked about it, that you weren't going to be one of those guys. We've all seen the coaches, the coach into their 70s, into their 80s even, and just can't seem to give it up. And you always said, I'm not going to be that guy, and you weren't. Has retirement been what you hoped for or what you expected?
It's been great. It's I've been so fortunate to get to do the things that I like to do. And a big part of that was healthy years of retirement, Steve. If you get into your 70s, I'm sorry, it just, you know, it's tougher to do things. And so playing a lot of golf, spending a lot of time with my granddaughter here in town and my grandson in Oklahoma when I can get out there or they can come here, playing some tennis occasionally, traveling. There's a lot that you never have the freedom to do, and you kind of don't realize that until you do retire.
Coach, I'm curious. Sometimes we think of those coaches that feel like they're going to coach right up until their deathbed. And it's, we say that it's all they know. And in a lot of ways, I think we attribute their success sometimes to that they're so singularly focused that they're just a coach from day one to the bitter end, if you will. Do you think in a way, the fact that you have this well-rounded life and perspective and you have other interests, do you think that helped you in your coaching career?
It definitely helped me. I mean, golf was a great game for off-season basketball, and I looked forward to it. I didn't ever want to lose that last game, but I used to have a goal of being on the golf course the day after that last game. Something to look forward to. But I think everyone's story is different. I think some guys coach forever because they can't think about themselves is anything other than the coach at whatever university and the fame that comes with that. Some just literally love coaching so much that they don't ever want to quit. So there's not a right way or a wrong way. And I don't think that I get any credit for having a well-rounded life. That sort of was a selfish decision of my own.
Well, I think you deserve some credit because you're a fascinating guy to talk to about basketball or other things as well. And a lot of people out there know you timed your retirement pretty darn well in terms of the final team you had and getting to the NCAA tournament and winning a game for the first time in Belmont history in the NCAA tournament. It was a pretty good time to go out, but you also timed it perfectly to miss what came next
right.
in college basketball and in society with the COVID pandemic and all that. When you look at the job that Casey Alexander, your old player and assistant coach, has done now back at Belmont, how do you evaluate what he's done, and how much do you have to look at it through the prism of how difficult COVID was on everybody, particularly college athletes and their coaches?
Well, one of the reasons I don't really do much commentary is I don't like to evaluate coaches, but I don't think there's any question that Casey was a great choice for Belmont and that basketball program. It's hard to evaluate because everybody else was dealing with the pandemic too. I mean, everybody had to figure out their way to do it. I can't imagine how difficult that was. And I think he handled it and the staff handled it great. Their teams have been very good. Last year, I'm sure, was a disappointment a little bit to all of them. I had plenty of teams loaded with seniors that didn't quite live up to what we hoped that they would live up to. I think that's what happened with them. But Casey does so many things about the job and his staff and his players that that make it a special basketball program.
Yeah, well, 77 wins over the 3 years only. I'm looking at my notes here. Gonzaga, Kansas, Houston, and Baylor are the only programs with more in that span. And I think it says a lot about where Belmont basketball is, that you win 25 games and you get an at-large berth to the NIT. And in some circles, probably mostly within the locker room, it maybe was looked at as a bit of a disappointment at the end of the year.
That's a good point. It is. The first time we got one of those was 2003. And I thought, well, this may be the height of it all, literally. I mean, for a new Division I program to get an at-large bid to the NIT. It's nice to think that you're disappointed with that when so many hundreds, literally, of Division I programs are just trying to get to that spot.
Well, now they embark on the journey into the Missouri Valley Conference. You understand transition very well because you helped usher Belmont into NCAA Division I, into the Atlantic Sun, then from the A-Sun into the OVC, and now it's off to the Missouri Valley Conference for this program. And I saw a couple weeks ago, Coach, that Belmont was ranked sixth in the preseason poll in the Valley, and I believe that's the lowest preseason ranking for a Belmont program since your first season in the A-Sun. That's how much respect you guys have around the country. What do you think the challenge is, or maybe the biggest part of the challenge of moving into this new level of college basketball for the Bruins?
I think it's the biggest challenge for the program, maybe for the entire athletic department, but certainly for men's basketball since we went from NAIA to Division I. From independent to the A-Sun, we were able to have pretty immediate success, and we certainly transitioned to the OVC well. This is a different world, and it doesn't come at a perfect time for this program because they lost so many good players. And I saw them practice the other night. I think they're pretty good, doing a lot of good things. But it is a huge step. And I think you'll see it mostly in how difficult it is to beat the bottom half of the conference versus what happened for the previous almost 20 years.
Yeah, there's no easy nights. You're not going to just walk into somebody else's gym with your C game in the Missouri Valley Conference and win basically on any night.
No, you're right. That's the biggest difference. I mean, I think that they will hold their on at home very well. And I think that we can take a lot of pride over the years, and Casey's continued it at playing well on the road. But again, it's a grind. A conference season is a grind, and you can jump out there and occasionally upset a North Carolina or UCLA. But if we'd been playing those teams during the conference season on their home court, it would have been a different game.
Rick, you mentioned the new look roster that Casey's going to have as they make this transition this year. And I'm curious, because during your 33 years at Belmont and your coaching in general, you've had all the experiences. You've had the loaded team with experience coming back. You've had the young team. You've had the roster turnover and all that. I don't know if I want to ask you what you prefer, but when you're in the example of Casey right now, is there something about being a coach or maybe in the blood of trying to figure things out with the team that gets you extra excited about a coach when you have all these different pieces and you have to figure out how they all fit together?
Well, by the way you asked that question, you understand it completely. There's a lot to that. We had a pretty bad record during our first few years, in Division I. We knew that was going to happen, but in many ways, it was the most fun time of my college coaching career, trying to make all that work and put it together, and maybe even say trying to coach to win a game instead of trying to coach not to lose. And there's a real different mentality about that. So I think Casey and his staff and hopefully the players are taking this as a challenge instead of playing prevent defense, which Belmont's kind of had to do here for several years now. And that's a tougher mentality. It's nice. It's nice that you got there. But I'll be surprised if Casey's not more interested and invigorated to getting to practice every day than maybe the past few years.
Yeah, he gets to chart his own course now. He followed you up very well and continued the winning success, and that's impressive in its own right. But now he gets a chance to do something that he's never done and the program's never done, and I'm sure that's exciting. Coach, I want to ask you a little bit now about some of the specifics of your time at Belmont. We all know 33 years, but way back in 1985, you made the decision to go there. What was it in 1985 that attracted you to come to Nashville and coach the Belmont Bruins?
Well, I had been an assistant coach at Tennessee Tech for 3 years before going to Lincoln Memorial, and Cookeville's big city is Nashville. And so I just found out a lot more about Nashville by watching the news at night and reading the newspapers and all the things that you did back then before there was internet. And then we played them, LMU played them, the middle year of my 3 years at LMU. And we did all right. And I think maybe that helped impress the Belmont folks a little bit. But I just thought Belmont, it turns out I was right about this. I don't know how much I'm ever right about, but I thought Belmont as an institution had a lot of potential. That's a big part of trying to build a basketball program or athletic program, particularly if you want to do it in the way we chose to do it. And that is to attract sort of real students that are good athletes, that appreciate the school, that are a fit for the school. And Belmont has plenty of good things, had back then, and now certainly has so many impressive things to offer young folks trying to decide where they're going to go to college.
Well, you are certainly right in your prognostication about the potential growth for Belmont. And we've seen that in athletics, and we've certainly seen that with the university as a whole. Was the fact that you were right and that the growth continued pretty much throughout the entire time you were there, is that part of what kept you there? The vision sort of kept building on itself and things kept getting bigger, or what was it that ultimately kept you there for more than three decades?
I don't know that I've thought about that linking to my longevity. I just think more about when you reach a certain point in your life, at least in my case, you've been where you are now for quite a while, and you find that the quality of life is what you were looking for and what matters and becomes to matter a lot more than the dollars or the fame of a higher level. And it was a great fit for me, and I hoped it was a good fit for Belmont. And I got to coach the greatest kids in the world. I got to choose them, and trying to choose great ones was real important to all of us on the staff. But then I got to be around them. So it was really easy. It was really easy for me to not think about going elsewhere.
Boy, you're right. It was a good fit between you and Belmont. And I guess I think a little bit about my own journey in some regards is I'll be at 12 years in Nashville coming up at some point during this college basketball season this winter. And I don't know the exact moment, Rick, when I just would have told myself Nashville is unequivocally home and probably home for the long term, but it happened somewhere in there several years ago. Yep. And now I really can't imagine something else. Was there a moment in your head where you had that, I don't know if it's an epiphany or not, but thought to yourself, Belmont is home and I'm going to be here for a long time?
Well, I think I always hoped that was the case, but I think probably when we turned the corner, Steve, and became successful in Division I, because there were a whole lot of coaches that lost their jobs on this transition from either usually Division II to Division I, some NAIA to Division I. It's just hard, and it's hard for an administration to have patience, regardless of past success. And so once we started rolling in the right direction, it made me feel more sure about my future there, because, you know, I don't know that I can tell you the exact numbers of those first 5 years, but the fourth one was something like 7-21 and was an awful year, the worst we ever had. It was a senior dominated team that we expected a lot from. And, so it was a climb. Anyway, I can't pick the moment out either. By the time I reached a point in my career at the Division I level where there was enough success on my resume for others to be interested, I was in my mid-50s. And people do make moves at that age bracket, but I was just sort of too far ingrained in Nashville and Belmont at that point.
Well, there was one moment, and this was pretty much at the moment I got to Nashville, and you had one of your best teams at Belmont and went to the NCAA tournament, and the Tennessee job came open. And for those who know you, you grew up a Tennessee fan, your dad, famous sports writer in that part of the state and around Tennessee Vol athletics. There was some talk and certainly some rumors that linked you with that job then. And of course, you know, former Tennessee athletic director Mike Hamilton, who was in charge of the search at that point in time. How close was that to actually happening? Were our fears real at the time, or was too much made about that?
I'm not sure too many were scared about that, but no, I mean, I've said before that I interviewed with Mike and a committee about it. It was after Bruce Pearl's departure and the circumstances behind it. I thought, as a Knoxville native and a Tennessee graduate, that maybe this was a good place for me to try to turn some of that stuff around that had gone on. At the same time, I knew that succeeding a guy with the personality of Bruce Pearl with a personality like mine was probably going to be a big challenge.
You weren't going to paint your chest and go to one of the women's games?
The second part, maybe, but for sure. But at any rate, it didn't happen. I mean, I did interview and I wasn't offered the job. And it's easy for me to say this, that I was mostly glad that I didn't get that call. But I just felt so great about where I was. That would have torn me in half trying to figure that out. And maybe too much I would have made too much out of the amount of money that I was going to make. And that's not really a good reason. Hard to turn down, but not really a great reason to make the decision at that point.
Yeah. That was maybe the most public instance where people thought maybe this would be the moment that would get you to leave Belmont. Was that as close as you ever were, or was there another time along 33 years that there was an opportunity that you were maybe thinking about?
It was the only one that I had a real reason to think about that I would have a decision to make. And, you know, a lot of it, Steve, is initial reaching out. And if I was not going to be interested, that's just what I told them. I didn't want to linger on. I certainly didn't ever try to quote unquote use those offers at Belmont. I never went to Dr. Fisher and asked for a raise. Mike Strickland took care of all that kind of stuff that was going on. I did want it to help our program sometimes because we needed some help in some positions and a little bit of funding and recruiting and those kind of things to be up to speed with the people we were competing with. But personally, I don't think that's the right thing to do.
I know from talking to you over the years, you're incredibly proud, obviously, of the success on the court, but maybe just as much or more so about the fact that you graduated all the guys who stayed and were in your program throughout the time there. You are proud of the relationships you have and the fact that so many of them have gone on to be successful in other walks of life as well. I'm curious, as you look at college basketball right now and you see the new era with NIL deals and the transfer portal and everything that's kind of enveloping the sport these days, two-part question. Can college basketball as a whole serve that same mission that you always coached with? And can Belmont continue to do it the way Belmont has done it so well and so successfully for you and now Casey in this current environment?
I think the predominant answer to both sides of that, the two questions, is no. Now, that doesn't mean it isn't going to be as popular. You know, a whole lot of stuff has happened, and there's still, I saw a lot of people in Neyland Stadium a couple weeks, you know, 10 days ago or 8 days ago or whenever that was. If you win with whatever is out there, I mean, John Calipari changed the face of recruiting in some ways, and everybody had to follow suit by taking the one-and-done kind of guys who thought Duke would have done that at some point. So I think the hard part is, and Casey's already faced it, is our success was built on finding guys that fit our style of play and our culture and whatever you want to call that, but also we're a little bit under the radar.
Rick, I appreciate all the insight and the answers here. I've got a few questions here before we go, and I'm going to try and make this kind of a feature of the program. I want to ask these three to essentially everybody who comes on the podcast, because I just think they're interesting insights that aren't necessarily specific about you, but tell us a lot about what you think and what you believe in.
Well, so Steve, these answers that I'm going to give are going to be the best you've ever seen, right? Since no one else has been on the podcast.
I was going to say, there's nothing to compare it to. They're the only answers at this point. So you are legitimately setting the bar for everybody else, right?
It'll be pretty low. Go ahead.
Well, the first one is, if you never got into coaching, which was your entire life in terms of your work career, what would you have done?
I never thought about doing anything else. So that's a hard one. I was an education major. Even if I didn't coach the high school team or wherever I would go, I probably would have been a teacher. But I was one a little bit at Maryville College and at Tennessee Tech. And I went to Tennessee Tech as assistant coach, and I'm all of a sudden a community health teacher. Heaven help those mostly young ladies that were nursing or whatever, that had to take that class. But I would have had to work a little harder at my teaching if that's what I was.
Well, you turned into a heck of a teacher on the basketball court, that's for sure. The second question is, and this one I think particularly strikes home with me in terms of college basketball, because when I talk to so many coaches out there, it feels like, and I may be wrong about this, but it feels like oftentimes wins become more relief than enjoyment in the high pressure cooker that is college basketball. So I'm curious what drove you. Was it the thrill of victory? Was it avoiding the agony of defeat or fear of failure, however you want to put it in there? What was it for you that when you, you sat down and you started game planning for the next opponent, what was it that drove you to be as successful as you were?
Oh, gosh. When you first asked the question, I started to say, I think that's just coaching in general. I mean, I think that's being a middle school coach. If you really care whether you win or lose, or a B team coach or whatever level, it's the competitiveness of it all. And that fits your two narratives there about are you the agony of defeat, or, you know, I think it depends on where your program is. That's why I said in many ways, those first few years of trying to build the program at Maryville College, trying to build the program at Belmont. LMU had some winning teams when I took over there, trying to then flip Belmont from NAIA to Division I success. That was in many, many ways more fun because I was trying to win. And then when you get to the point where you've been on the top, at the top, close, and people expect better and better and better and better, but it's not only people, it's yourself. I did not want to back up, Steve. I didn't want our program to back up, and we may have taken a half a step backwards. You can't be perfectly better every year. So that part is internal. It's a whole lot more about yourself than it is about what you think other people are thinking.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think maybe even the Tennessee example in football right now is that point. When you haven't been there for a while and you're on the up climb, there's so much excitement about it because the expectation isn't there. Maybe the pressure isn't there. And so you just get to enjoy the thrill of the climb, where when you get to the top, you're worried about somebody else knocking you off.
Well, think about Alabama's football program. Now, if they had won a home game like Tennessee won that home game, they would have been disappointed that it went that far and it was that close. And so that's exactly right.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Okay, last one here. And this one's truly a wide open question for you, but I'm curious, when you have one of those great days, whether that's winning a conference championship back in the day, I won't ask about the NCAA tournament because I know you just hopped on a plane and you had to work all night to get down to Jacksonville off that, but you won a conference tournament or a regular season back in the day, you get a massive recruit, or maybe it's now and you have the grandkids over for a great weekend or something like that. At the end of the day, when you sit down with Cheryl, what's kind of your veg out guilty pleasure thing? Do you open a bottle of wine? Do you watch a TV show? Do you have a steak dinner? What's the way you celebrate at the end of a great day?
Well, we don't drink. Soft drinks are less expensive than alcoholic beverages, and I'm pretty conservative with my money. The closest thing that you said, and it's pretty true, is we've got a subscription to Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, ESPN Plus, you name, we think we're saving money off of cable or satellite, but we're spending just as much on the options that gives us. And we really do like finding a series that we like and sitting down and watching that. I think back in the days when you mentioned winning a conference tournament, one of the greatest things was taking the team somewhere in Macon after we'd won the ASUN down there, or going to little bar tavern place in Chapel Hill after we'd beaten North Carolina that day. are going out with my daughter and her husband and Cheryl at UCLA. And those were the best for sure. And so just spending those times with the people you care about and sharing it with them is my best answer.
Yeah, those are special moments. Real quick, you got a Netflix recommendation? I'm in need of a new series here.
Oh, gosh. This is an old one, but still one of my favorite, called The Fall.
Okay.
So check that out. See what you think.
Okay? I have to. I'm about to move on from – I've been big in Ted Lasso here lately, but I'm going to get to the end, and I'm going to have to move on to something
else. I didn't mention Apple TV. We got that one too. Disney Plus for little Ada. We've got it all.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Rick, it's great to talk to you. I know I'm going to see you more this winter with basketball back. It's an exciting time, and we appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Steve.